right, welcome back. Our next speaker will be Carl Bradley from the University of Kentucky, discussing fungicide resistance in the frog eye leaf spot of soybean pathogen, a case example. And I'll stand up 5 minutes.
Well, thank you very much. As mentioned, I'm Carl Bradley. I'm an extension plant pathologist at the University of Kentucky. I've been at Kentucky for a little bit over a year. A lot of the research that I'm going to be talking about today is from when I was at the University of Illinois a few years ago. First, I just want to talk a little bit about recent fungicide use on field crops. And when I'm referring to field crops, I'm really talking about corn and soybean. And for many years, there really wasn't a whole lot of use of foliar fungicides. In fact, on soybean, there really weren't any foliar fungicides registered, or maybe just one or two products. And all that really changed in the mid to late 2000s, where we saw a dramatic increase in foliar fungicide use on corn and soybean in the Midwest. And prior to that time, it was pretty sporadic, where we would see foliar fungicide use on corn in seed production on corn inbreds. So we would see that, but on regular yellow dent corn production fields, we really wouldn't see any. And soybean was along the same lines. So all this, really, the big moment was in 2007. That's when we had a lot of fungicides being applied to corn and soybean. And I was able to get this graph from a company that keeps track of sales of fungicides. And from this data, this is looking at fungicide sales in the north central U.S. In 2007 versus the year before, 2006. And you can see that many of those products, the sale increased by 170% in some cases. So there was a lot more fungicides sold in 2007 versus the year before. And so there were some different things behind why we saw this increase of foliar fungicide use on corn and soybean in the Midwest. One of those things was back in 2004, soybean rust was detected in the continental U.S. For the very first time, and that was in Louisiana. And then later on, it was found in some other states. And so that really started to ramp up the number of registrations that were submitted and for soybean. Originally, a lot of these started off as Section 18 emergency exemptions because there were no products that were registered at that time, and then later on rolled into regular Section 3 labels for soybean. And then also that ramped up production with the threat of soybean rust in the U.S. And since then, we've gone about 12 years now since that's happened, and we really have not had any significant soybean rust in the Midwest, where the major soybean production occurs in the U.S., although it does occur regularly in the southeastern U.S. and the south, and it can be found in the Midwest, but it's always much later in the year when it hasn't done any damage. But regardless, that did sort of open the window for a lot of registrations of fungicides on soybean and ramping up of production of fungicides. Also, during that time, we saw some historically high commodity prices. Just taking a look here, where soybean is the orange bar and corn is the blue bar. And you can see, just right around 2007 there, is when we started to see prices go up and had continued to relatively increase until more recently, and especially into 2016, where we've seen prices kind of go back down to where they were before. But during that period, with the higher prices for these commodities, there was a lot more feeling that farmers might be willing to spend a little bit more money on inputs and to produce greater yields during that time. And then during that time, and we continue to see this, is increased advertising and marketing of foliar fungicides for corn and soybean, and not necessarily to pick on any companies, but these are the type of themes, slogans that we see now on billboards and TV and radio commercials that are being broadcasted during important times during the season. And one of the things that are often noticeably missing, especially from a plant pathology perception, is the lack of speaking about disease control. And lots of times it's more about increasing the plant production, increasing yield. And so sometimes that message of disease control is lost, and that might make farmers want to apply fungicides in the hopes of getting a higher yield, regardless of what type of disease pressure might be present. So when I was at the University of Illinois, we had a series of meetings that we would conduct in January across the state. They were called the Corn and Soybean Classics, and this was a good place to try to ask questions of the audience members of why they might apply fungicides. And so we had several meetings that year at different locations, as you can see in the state there on the map, and we used the Turning Point technology to ask some different questions. In total, in these six locations, we had 905 total responses. And the type of people that were in attendance, you can see the different representation there by occupation. The highest percentage of respondents were producers, followed by ag retailers, and then seed company representatives. And so one of the questions I asked, did you spray or advise someone to spray a fungicide on corn in 2008? So this would have been for the previous season. These meetings were held in January of 2009. And you can see that 65% of the respondents did say yes, that they did spray or advise someone to spray a fungicide on corn in 2008. And it was soybean, it was a little bit closer, almost 50-50, but the majority in this case said they did not, but still 47% said that they did. On soybean. But what I really wanted to try to get at from these questions was what important factors did these audience members consider whenever they were making a foliar fungicide application. And so I gave them some different choices: the marketing price of the crop, the amount of disease pressure, the susceptibility of the variety or hybrid that was being used, the weather, and then finally the potential for higher yields. And I didn't have enough room to leave it all there. It was the potential for higher yields without thinking about disease pressure, basically, or regardless of disease pressure, I think is how it was worded. And you can see that the majority picked things that a plant pathologist might like to see. When we talk, we like to talk about the disease triangle. And so really these three components in the middle there are really relative to the disease triangle. So the amount of disease pressure, the variety susceptibility, and the weather. Those are kind of things that make up that disease triangle. But we still had about a quarter of the audience that picked factors that were not related to the disease triangle, really not related to diseases at all. It was really more about the marketing price of the crop or just the hope for higher yields regardless of disease pressure. So with all these things coming together, we've continued to see a trend of much higher foliar fungicide use on corn and soybean than we had ever seen before. And with that comes the potential of fungicide resistance. And in fact, that did happen in 2010, where my lab was the first to identify resistance in the pathogen that causes frog-eye leaf spot of soybean, and resistance to strobilurin fungicides. So just a little bit about frog-eye leaf spot. You can see the symptoms there. It causes lesions or spots on leaves. It's caused by the fungus Cercospora sojina. This can be found throughout the Midwest, but historically it's a larger problem as you get to more of those transition areas in the southern states. So when I was in Illinois, this was a disease I would rarely find in northern Illinois, but as I went to southern Illinois, I would find it much more often. And now that I'm in Kentucky, this is one of the primary diseases that farmers have to battle in regards to foliar diseases of soybean. As far as management, there are different options. Crop rotation is one that can help reduce the amount of inoculum that's available for the next year. Resistant varieties are also available. In fact, there's a gene known as the RCS3 gene that so far has been found to be effective against all known races of this pathogen that exists in North America. So there are some varieties that do contain that, and they're highly resistant. And then, of course, foliar fungicides, whenever the QOI, or also known as strobilurin fungicides, were first registered on soybean back in the early to mid-2000s, growers in the southern U.S. found that that was a very good fungicide to use for controlling frog eye leaf spot. So just a little bit about the strobilurin fungicides. Actually, the official name of this class of fungicides is the quinone outside inhibitors. And similar to some of the other speakers in this session, there's also a group, and this is called the FREC group, in this case, Fungicide Resistance Action Committee, groups these fungicides into different chemistry classes. And so this particular group is in FREC group 11, and this does include the strobilurin fungicides. The mode of action of this chemistry class is a respiration inhibitor, and then the site of action and where it gets the name QOI inhibitor is that it inhibits the quinol oxidizing site of the cytochrome BC1 complex in the fungus, and this has a high efficacy of inhibiting spore germination. The FRAC group has characterized the QOI or strobilurin fungicides as a group with a high risk of fungi developing resistance to that group, and this is because resistance has been reported in over 20 different fungal species to this QOI fungicide group. And in fact, this happened well before we've documented fungicide resistance in the Cercospora sylgina pathogen. So we knew that potentially this could be a real issue because of its high risk. There are three different mutations that have been characterized in fungi that have resistance to these QOI fungicides. And these are listed here, the G143A, the F129L, and the G137R mutations. These all have to do with a single-step amino acid substitution. So, for example, for the G143A mutation, that's a shift from a glycine to an alanine in codon 143 of the cytochrome B gene of the fungus. So just thinking about fungicide resistance and what really makes up resistance, and in fact, this probably holds true for insecticide resistance and herbicide resistance as well. It really comes down to two factors, selection pressure, and we know historically, we knew already that the QOI fungicides had a very high risk because of their high selection pressure and their single site of action. So that part was already in place. The other part really has to do with in this case, the pathogen, and that's the genetic diversity. How much genetic diversity actually exists in this pathogen population? And from some work that I was involved with prior to this fungicide resistance work, we had looked at genetic diversity of several isolates of Cercospora sylgina from the U.S., and from those of you that are familiar with these type of diagrams, the more branches you have, basically the more diverse diversity exists in this population. And so from this work, as well as some work from some other authors, have shown that this particular fungus is highly diverse. Lots of genetic diversity already out there. So we kind of have both of those things in place. We have the high selection pressure, and we have the high level of genetic diversity already in place. And so normally when we want to evaluate fungicide resistance, one of the first steps is to develop a baseline sensitivity level. And so to do this for Cercospora sylgina, that meant that I had to have isolates of this fungus that had never been exposed to QOI fungicides. Okay? And that's one of the things that can be very difficult to do. Fortunately, I had a collaborator, a colleague, down at the University of Georgia, Dr. Dan Phillips, who's now retired. But Dr. Phillips had been working on Cercospora sylgina for a number of years and had kept an isolate collection that dated back to the 1960s. And so I was able to have access to these isolates that predated the registration and use of the QOI fungicides in soybean. So I used about 50 of these isolates to determine the baseline sensitivity, how sensitive this population is that had never before been exposed to strobilurin fungicides. And of course, to do this, we had to have an assay. We used a Petri dish assay where we looked at spore germination of the fungus on different concentrations of the fungicide that was in the growth media. So basically, it sort of looked like this. And for these kind of work, you always have to have lots of graduate students because this is very tedious work as well. But basically, they looked at spore germination about 18 hours after those spores were put on those plates. And you can see in this example here, a germinated spore and a non-germinated spore. And ultimately, by looking at this over these different concentrations of fungicides, we were able to determine the EC50, which is the effective concentration of the fungicide that inhibited spore germination by 50%. So the higher the EC50 level, that meant the less sensitive that particular isolate was that particular fungicide. So we did this for three of the QOI fungicides, azoxystrobin, paraclostrobin, and trifloxystrobin. And you can see from this diagram here, looking at their EC50 levels of those 50 isolates, that there is some inherent differences in efficacy. And this is not uncommon. Even though these three fungicides are in the same chemistry class, their level of intrinsic activity might vary a little bit. And this same relationship had been observed in other fungi, which other authors had done this same type of work. So once we had that baseline sensitivity established, then the next step was to go out into the field and collect isolates that had been exposed to strobilurin or QOI fungicides. And so I was able to get a grant from the Illinois Soybean Association to do this work. So initially, a lot of this work was done inside the state of Illinois, where from 2007 to 2009, we focused on some of our own research sites that we had throughout the state, as well as going to growers' fields that we had known they had sprayed a strobilurin fungicide. And we'd go out and collect leaves and then collect spores and evaluate. Once we had our methodology down pretty well in 2010, we actually opened it up to beyond Illinois, and we asked contributors or colleagues from other universities and states to send us samples if they would like. And so basically the process was we would receive leaves, we would cross our fingers that that the lesions on the leaves would be sporulating. That would be the best case scenario. If so, we could directly take some of those spores and get individual single-spored isolates, which is what you see there on the right, and then we would test those on those series of different concentrations to get EC50s for each one of those isolates. And so we would do that based on spore germination, as I discussed earlier. So this is looking at azoxystrobin. And again, you can see our baseline sensitivity here on the left was at 0.013 parts per million of azoxystrobin. And then we had our isolates that we collected from 2007. And you can see in this case, although not statistically different, we actually saw that those isolates were a little bit more sensitive to the fungicide. You can see how the EC50 actually dropped a little bit. But then we began to test in 2008 and then 2009, and you can see in 2009 there that statistically those isolates were less sensitive. The mean was at least less sensitive than the mean of the baseline population. So we could start to see this trend. And although I don't have the graphs here in this presentation to show it, we saw this exact same trend for the other two fungicides, the trifloxystrobin and the paraclostrobin that we evaluated. So that was from 2007 to 2009, and then 2010 came. And you can see now where we had a huge shift in sensitivity. In fact, when comparing to the baseline population, which was at about 0.013 parts per million, the mean of the 2010 isolates was about 3.1, and that was over a 250-fold increase in EC50 or decrease in sensitivity compared to the baseline population. So a huge shift in sensitivity where we were now seeing a lot of isolates out there that were highly resistant. And this was really due to isolates collected in three different states. And you can see in these counties here that are colored where those fields came from, two in southern Illinois, southeastern Illinois, one in western Kentucky, and then two fields in western Tennessee. So that was where the first documentation of resistant isolates occurred in those five different fields. So we were able to show, using an in vitro method in a petri dish, that the sensitivity had changed. But to be sure that we were absolutely correct and to confirm this on the plant, we wanted to run some greenhouse evaluations. So we took isolates that we were found from the in vitro test, from the petri dish test, that were sensitive to strobilurin fungicides and those that were resistant to strobilurin fungicides. And then we inoculated plants in the greenhouse, and then we sprayed those plants with different fungicides. We sprayed them with QOI fungicides. We also sprayed those with fungicides from different chemistry classes, such as the demethylation inhibitor group, or DMIs, also known as triazoles. And then we used another fungicide from the benzimidazole group, known as Topsin. And we used the Weed Scientist spray chamber to spray these plants, and then we inoculated, put those in a humidity chamber to have sufficient environment for infection. And as you can see from these pictures here, we were able to get a high level of infection. Here you're looking at the unifoliate leaves. And the non-breeding control is on the left, and you can see the three different QOI fungicides that were sprayed on the right, and so therefore you can see that in fact these isolates were highly resistant to these QOI fungicides. And then when we look at the other fungicides from the different chemistry groups, the DMI fungicide down at the bottom and the MBC fungicide, you can see that we had a high level of control. So once we were able to confirm this, we were able to get some support from the United Soybean Board and really open this up to a multi-state project. And another objective then was to just find out how widespread these isolates actually were. So we wanted to continue to monitor to detect additional isolates with this resistance to QOI fungicides. We also wanted to characterize these QOI-resistant isolates to determine which mutation was responsible for this resistance. And then I'm an extension plant pathologist, so from that perspective, we want to be able to give information back to growers on how to manage this problem. And so we wanted to have some trials to evaluate that. But first, just looking at continued monitoring to detect additional isolates. The methods that I explained previously took a lot of work. So for one isolate, we would have one isolate. We would have to take that across four different concentrations of fungicides and a non-amended control to determine the EC50. So we wanted to be able to streamline this. So to streamline this process, we developed a discriminatory dose assay, and we had determined that 0.1 part per million of azoxystrobin was the amount of fungicide that you needed to discriminate between a resistant isolate and a sensitive isolate. And as you can see from this diagram, you can see from the resistant isolate up here at the top what it looks like in the non-amended control media, what it looked like with 0.1 part per million azoxystrobin, and then with the sensitive isolate where in the non-amended control it grew fine, but with 0.1 part per million azoxystrobin, it did not grow. So we were able to streamline this process, and had been working on this since 2011, looking at other states, and then I have a number of other colleagues that started doing this in their own lab as well. And so this is basically the culmination of where we have found resistant isolates from 2010 up through 2015. And each one of those different colors there on each county or parish, if we're talking about Louisiana, indicates the year that it was first found. So purple would be the 2010 finds, then red 2011, green 2012, kind of that pinkish color 2013, and then light blue 2014, and dark blue 2015. So you can see that we have really basically found that these isolates are present across a large area that grows soybeans. We haven't really found a whole lot in the Midwest, in the meat of the soybean production. A few finds in Illinois, a few in Indiana. We have looked in Iowa. Dr. Darren Mueller at Iowa State has sent us several isolates, but we have not yet documented it. But where this is more of, this disease is more of an issue in those southern states, the fungicide-resistant isolates are quite prevalent. The next step then was to characterize these isolates to determine which mutation was present. To do this type of work, I relied on some of my colleagues with much more molecular experience than myself, in which we sequenced the cytochrome B gene of the fungus in both sensitive and resistant isolates, and we did find that those resistant isolates had a glycine for alanine shift at codon 143, which goes back to some of those previous slides, the G143A mutation. As it turns out, that G143A mutation is the most common mutation for all of the fungi that have developed resistance to QOY fungicides. So that was not a big surprise that that would be the mutation that we found. The other thing about this particular mutation is that it is highly resistant. When a fungus has this particular mutation, that means that it becomes about 100-fold less sensitive than a baseline population, and really means that the disease cannot be controlled by upping the rate of the fungicide. It would be, you would have to apply 600 times the amount of fungicide to get the same level of control, which is impossible to do that. Also, to help streamline some of the sampling and determination of resistance, a molecular assay was developed that could identify this G143A mutation. And just to show you here where we have that band present, those are all isolates that had been confirmed as being resistant using our Petri dish assay. And those where the band is not present are those that were determined to be sensitive. So this assay did work very well, and it did help us, again, streamline this process. And in some cases, where we might receive samples where we would not be able to get an isolate of the fungus. This is a kind of a tricky fungus to work with a little bit. So as I mentioned earlier, we'd cross our fingers that samples would come in, that they would be sporulating, so we could actually just grab the fungus. But in some cases, that could not happen, so we could use the molecular assay to determine resistance. And then finally, management. Now that we know that this QI-resistant isolates are present in several places across the U.S., how are we going to manage disease, frog eye leaf spot, caused by these isolates? So I'm only going to show data from 2015, just because the data that I have from 2011, 2012, 2013, and 2014 all look exactly the same, okay? But for 2015, we had a trial at two different locations. 2015 was my transition year from University of Illinois to University of Kentucky, so I have locations in both states. And in this case, we looked at fungicides that were applied at the R3 beginning pod stage of soybean, and to be sure that we had a high level of frog eye leaf spot present, we planted in areas known to have frog eye leaf spot, as well as planted a highly susceptible variety. And if you can see from that picture down at the bottom, that's a picture from one of our untreated checks there, and you can see a high level of frog eye leaf spot present in that particular location. This is looking at the Princeton, Kentucky location from 2015, looking at frog eye leaf spot severity. So it's on a percentage scale. The higher the percentage, the higher level of leaf area that was affected by lesions. And if I put in the chemistry class there, you can see our non-treated check was basically the same as our headline, in this case, headline fungicide, which is a QOI fungicide. So we had a highly resistant population present in this field. It was just naturally present. And then, as you can see, when we sprayed fungicides from other chemistry groups, the DMIs, in some cases, some are mixtures with QOIs. Here's the Topsin, which is a different chemistry class, MVC fungicide. But regardless, the good news is if we use other chemistry classes, we were able to reduce the level of disease. And so that's good news in regards to managing this disease. Just some pictures. Here's our non-treated control, and you can see a pretty high level of disease there. Here's our QOI headline fungicide. looks pretty similar to the non-treated control. And here's a triazole fungicide. We sprayed the two middle rows, so basically rows 1 and 4 are untreated checks. And as you look back here, you can definitely see a color difference between the non-sprayed rows and the two middle sprayed rows. So we definitely had a high level of disease and were able to get a good level of management with an effective fungicide. Later on, I took some pictures later on just to look at leaf retention. And here's our non-treated check, our strobilurin or QOI fungicide, and then our triazole or DMI fungicide here that leaves were still hanging on, which meant that photosynthesis probably occurred a little bit longer in those plots, which resulted into a significant yield difference where we saw about a 15 bushel per acre yield response with our effective fungicides, whereas with a straight QOI fungicide such as Headline in this case, no yield response. It was the same as the non-treated check. And then we saw the same thing basically at Dixon Springs as well, where the other fungicides from other chemistry classes were effective in reducing the level of disease, and that did result into a significant yield response with those effective fungicides. So the other thing that we wanted to look at in regards to field management of this disease, let me just back up a little bit. When I showed you that map with all of the different detections where we had found an isolate in a field that had resistance to QOI fungicides, in a lot of those cases, it did not mean that the grower did not get good control with the strobilurin fungicide. It just meant that we detected it, okay? And so there were a few cases, though, that because of a lack of efficacy of the fungicide, that prompted samples being sent to our lab. But in some cases, it was just kind of a random sample. And we may find in some of those cases that the QOI-resistant isolates made up only about 10% of the isolates that were in that field, where the other 90% were resistant, or were sensitive, okay? So that really brought the question is, at what level do we start to see loss of efficacy when we have, you know, what percentage of resistant isolates do we need out there where we start to see the loss of efficacy with a QOI fungicide? So we set up a couple of trials, one at Dixon Springs, Illinois in southeastern Illinois, and one in Milan, Tennessee, working with Dr. Melvin Newman, who's now retired but was with the University of Tennessee. In western Tennessee. And then we inoculated with different ratios of spores or conidia. So for instance, we would have QOI resistant and sensitive isolates, and we would inoculate different plots at different ratios, where one would be a 1-to-3 ratio, where the minority of the population were resistant isolates, and then 3/4 of the population were sensitive isolates, and then we inoculated some plots with equal ratios of spores, 1-to-1, and then some where the majority were resistant isolates and the minority were sensitive isolates. And then we either applied Headline, a QOI fungicide, or we applied TopGuard, which is a DMI fungicide, and then we evaluated frog eye leaf spot severity. So this is from 2011, from the trial that we had in southeastern Illinois at Dixon Springs, looking at frog eye leaf spot severity, again on that percentage of the leaf area affected scale. And what you're looking at here are the different ratios in which we inoculated. So, for instance, this first group of bars here is that 1-to-3 ratio, where 1 was the strobilurin resistant isolate, so it was the minority of the population, then a 1-to-1, and then a 3-to-1, where the strobilurin isolates were the majority of the population. Then we applied, we had our non-treated check, which was the blue bar, and then Headline, the QOI fungicide, was the red bar, and then TopGuard, the DMI fungicide, was the green bar. And I was actually a little bit surprised by this. My hypothesis was that Headline, in this case, where the strobilurin resistant isolates were in the minority, that it would look a lot more like Top Guard, but as you can see, that it does not. It looks like the non-treated check, whereas we did get a reduction in disease with the DMI fungicide, and then similar across the other ratios. Now, we looked at this at Dixon Springs in 2 years and in Milan, Tennessee in 2 years, and so things jump around a little bit, but that trend, this is looking at Dixon Springs the following year, that trend still exists, where even whenever the strobilurin or QOI resistant isolates were in the minority, that we were losing efficacy, that we did not see the same level of efficacy that we saw with the DMI fungicide. And then looking at Milan, at this particular year in 2011 in Milan, we did see sort of an in-between response there with the QOI fungicide, but still not as good as the DMI fungicide. And then looking at 2012 with a similar type of trend. So really kind of to boil it all down, what did we really find here? We found that the good news is fungicides from other chemistry classes were effective in managing frog eye leaf spot caused by this QOI resistant isolate. So we still have some things in the toolbox that farmers can use. Unfortunately, some of those fungicide chemistry classes also have either medium or potentially a high risk of fungi developing resistance to those chemistry groups. So that doesn't mean that we could just go and spray these fungicides all the time and never have a problem. But for the short term at least, they are solutions that could be used. And then again, we found that even if these strobilurin or QOI resistant isolates are in the minority of the population, we still did see a loss in efficacy with our QOI fungicides. Just to further this a little bit, some of the preliminary work that we had done, we had found that just by applying a strobilurin fungicide, if we sampled like 4 weeks after we applied and sampled right before we applied, we found that there was a major shift in sensitivity after we applied. So even if you don't see a loss in efficacy that first year, what you have essentially done is you have applied a major selection pressure, and the following year you'll have more isolates that are resistant. So what are our recommendations for controlling this disease? First off, there are other ways to manage this disease than just looking at foliar fungicides. As I mentioned earlier, soybean varieties that contain the RCS3 gene are highly effective in managing frog eye leaf spot. So growing resistant varieties is certainly one way to help manage this disease. And then applying products that contain mixtures of different active ingredients from different chemistry classes. There was if you were here for the earlier part of this session, there was a little bit of discussion by some of the other speakers in regards to tank mixing or mixing using products that contain different active ingredients versus sequential applications of different active ingredients. When it comes to soybean production or corn production, there's usually only about one timing in which the majority of growers might consider spraying a foliar fungicide. So the option of the sequential applications doesn't really apply to these crops. It may to fruit and vegetable crops that are a lot more intensively managed, but not to corn and soybean. And then fungicide resistance management in regards to why are we applying a fungicide? And that goes back to some of the advertising, some of the thoughts about these fungicides giving higher yields regardless of disease pressure, which in some cases is true. However, when we are applying these fungicides, when we don't need them in regards to disease control, we are exposing the pathogen population unnecessarily and potentially selecting out individuals that are resistant or less sensitive to these fungicides. So, going back to IPM and applying fungicides when they're warranted based on risk of disease and disease scouting observations. With that, I'd like to acknowledge the United Soybean Board and the Illinois Soybean Association for providing funding for a lot of this work, and then a number of collaborators from different universities and companies that helped helped a lot with this work in regards to sending samples and helping to identify the mechanisms of resistance in this pathogen. So with that, if I have time, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions. Good question. So your first question is how willing are growers, how willing are they to plant resistant varieties? And if I could get into the mind of a grower, I would be a much better extension person, I think. But as far as I can tell, there's no really yield drag involved that I've seen, at least. And I think a lot of it just has to do with the reasons why growers are picking their varieties. Obviously, yield is always number one, but in areas where frog eye leaf spot is more of a chronic issue, and I could say areas of western Tennessee, western Kentucky, southeastern Missouri, southern Illinois, where farmers deal with this year in and year out, that the frog eye leaf spot resistance should be sort of one of the top things that they're looking at. Whereas farmers that don't have a frequent problem with frog eye leaf spot, that particular trait should not become as important. I think with the availability of fungicides as well, that maybe has sort of changed how some producers think about what varieties they want to grow. And I've seen this in corn as well, where things like northern leaf blight, you know, in central and northern Illinois, you would not want to plant a variety or hybrid that would have a high susceptibility to that disease. But because of fungicides that are registered to control these diseases, they might be willing to plant a little bit more susceptible variety with the potential of a higher yields, and then count on spraying it with the foliar fungicide. So I think the thought process has changed a little bit now that fungicides are more in the mix than it did 20 years ago when that really wasn't an option. Any other questions? All right, thank you.